in fact, be back next week.
Positively revolting as ever.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
That program was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Case, Lang, and Vairs, an evening of music with songwriters Nico Case, Katie Lang, and Laura Vairs, Saturday, July 2nd at the Oregon Zoo. Tickets and information for Case, Lang, Vairs is at the zoo on July 2nd are available at zooconcerts.com. The time is 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for One Land, Many Voices.
Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the 29th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. This year, performers include Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dr. Joan and the Night Trippers, Maceo Parker, a Prince tribute with Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, and many, many more, plus two after-hours parties, dance competitions, six cruises, and 4th of July fireworks. This year, everyone will need a pass to enter the festival. Single-day passes go on sale June 1st, and early bird pricing has been extended to June 5th at 11:59 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, July 1st through 4th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
I got my headphones on, just don't block. Not a moment to waste, cause I feel the bass drop.
On One Land, Many Voices program, we feature a talk given on May 3rd by Israeli scholar Ilan Pepe at Evergreen State University in Olympia, Washington. The topic of this talk is, why is Palestine still the issue?
Good evening, everyone. It's really great to see so many folks come out for such an important event. Congratulations to Dakota on receiving the Memorial Scholarship. I struggled for several weeks over what to say tonight. It's rather difficult, at least I found, to decide how to introduce, and sorry, Ilana, if I make you blush, but how to introduce one of someone's moral and intellectual heroes, which is what Ilana is to me. I suppose one way that is as good as any is to maybe briefly talk about what Ilana's scholarship on and dedication to the question of Palestine have meant to my life. I'm reminded very often of September 15th, 2014, and that is the day that I arrived in Exeter, a city in the southwest of England. It was also the day that I received the news that Jose Gomez had passed away, a professor and a man who was very dear to me and dear to many people in this room I know. And as I think about that day arriving in Exeter, I think about the things that Jose taught me and the way in which he approached these issues that were so important to him. He approached these with integrity and with dedication and with this unapologetic honesty that really affected the way that I decided to pursue my academic goals. And I think it was only right that on the day that Jose passed, I was sort of transferred in one way or another into Ilan's hands. Who, just as Jose did, pursues the production of knowledge and the understanding and the analysis that we all need with those same qualities. Over the next few months, Ilan became the supervisor for my master's thesis, and with incredible guidance and support and care, really, I think, enhanced my ability to be successful at that level. and I've since gone on to support my academic pursuits by being an incredible support in the PhD application process. So his dedication to his students, I think, is unquestionable. In saying that, our speaker tonight is Ilan Pape. He is professor of history at the University of Exeter and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies. Prior to his arrival in the UK, Pape was a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Haifa in Israel and chair of the Emil Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies. Pape is perhaps best known for his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, a groundbreaking historical account of the formation of the State of Israel, sourced from previously unreleased British and Israeli military and governmental documents. His other works include The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel. With Noam Chomsky, Pape has co-authored Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on the U.S.-Israeli War Against the Palestinians, and most recently, co-authored with Noam Chomsky is the book On Palestine. Many of these books are available for sale in the back at the table provided by the Evergreen State College Bookstore, and Ilan will be graciously signing those after the talk. Pape's research focuses on the modern Middle East, the history of Israel and Palestine, settler colonialism, and critical discourse analysis. He is a prolific writer. His academic articles have appeared in Arab Studies Quarterly, the Journal of Palestine Studies, Theory, Culture, and Society, the Middle East Report, and many more. His analysis and expertise are often tapped by the BBC, Democracy Now!, Al Jazeera, and many other media outlets. Please join me in welcoming our lecturer tonight, Ilan Pape.
Thank you, Andrew. You made me blush, so I'll retaliate. Because your parents are here, and there's nothing more pleasurable than embarrass your student in front of their parents. It's a great honor to be introduced by one of my best students, and a great pleasure. It makes this evening, that in so many other ways, is special for me, even more special. It's a great honor to be chosen to give the inaugural lecture of the Rachel Corrie Memorial. It's a great task, and I hope to fulfill it with the commitment and courage and humanity that Rachel herself embodied as a human being, as a testimony to her legacy for all of us. Tonight's lecture is entitled is not entitled as a question, but as a statement. Palestine is still the issue. My original idea was to suggest a question mark. Is Palestine still the issue? But I thought that would be beginning the talk in a very negative way, in an apologetic way, and a defeatist way. And the last thing we need as activists who are committed to freedom, peace, and justice in Palestine is to put our own question marks of something we are entirely committed to and sure of. And that's why I decided not to put the title, Is Palestine Still the Question, Still the Issue, but rather state that Palestine is still the issue. Now, by this, I don't mean that for anyone in this room who has been engaged with Palestine, it ever stopped being the issue. I'm sure it hasn't. And that's not what I have in mind, trying to convince people for whom Palestine is such an important issue that they need to be reminded how important the struggle is. Every day brings an image that reminds those of us who may forget for a moment how important Palestine is, brings itself an image that brings us back in connection with what happens on the ground. The last image for me that did it is the face of 12-year-old Dima, who spent 75 days in Israeli jail, and especially the expression on her parents' face, the helplessness that they felt at the hands of such a cruel ruler who could do with their 12-year-old daughter whatever they wished without anyone having the ability to stop such an inhumanity. So we don't need reminder that Palestine is still the issue. But if we are less emotional and we are more political and practical and pragmatic, we do realize that it is not always easy these days to galvanize people around the Palestine issue. So much is happening in Syria and Iraq. So much is going on in the United States and in Europe. So much inhumanity and barbarism rages in so many other parts of the world in general, and in the Middle East in particular, that it's not surprising that some people feel that maybe Palestine is a lesser issue, of less importance, that the atrocities there pale in comparison to the barbarism and inhumanity in Syria or in Iraq. And I think for these people, who are good people, it is important to explain something that the mainstream media would never do, would never even attempt to explain. Why Palestine is still the issue, exactly because of the violence that rages in Syria, exactly because of the inhumanity that victimizes people in Yemen, in Libya, in Iraq, in other parts of the world. It's exactly because of that that we should make sure that people are aware of the connections between the story of Palestine and the inhumanity and barbarism that today affects the Middle East as a whole. And this kind of connection is not made by mainstream academia, is totally ignored by mainstream politicians, because it benefits them and their allies in the Middle East. But we should not succumb to this ignorance. We should not accept this superficial analysis. And we should insist that people would understand the connection between Palestine, the Middle East, the rights of indigenous people all around the world, the struggle of workers against neoliberal oppressive policies, and in general, the struggle for justice in our time. There are five reasons why Palestine is still the issue. Morally, it is the most important, by no means the only, but the most important struggle against settler colonialism. And Sydney has mentioned it, and Rachel has mentioned it in her own writing. The connection between the struggle of indigenous native people against settler colonialism and the struggle of Palestinians. This is something very important because we tend to forget the distinction, which is very crucial, between colonialism and settler colonialism. And in this country, we should be aware, probably more than any other part of the world, what is the difference between settler colonialism and colonialism. Settler colonialism is the movement of Europeans who were persecuted, who faced existential danger, and had to run away from Europe, whether they were Jews or Christians, and to find a safe haven somewhere. And they arrived in other people's homes. But they were not content with making the new home a safe home. They insisted on making the new homes homelands. And their idea of a homeland was a place which has no one else but themselves in that homeland. And they were propelled by a logic that one of the great scholars of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, who just passed away recently, called, they were propelled by the logic of elimination. In this country, the logic of elimination meant genocide. In Palestine, it meant expulsion, massive expulsion, and ethnic cleansing. In South Africa, it meant apartheid. There was a variety of ways in which to make the native disappear. You could physically kill them, You could enclave them in ghettos, or you could expel them. The intention was the same. The result was not always the same. And this is why the struggle in Palestine is more powerful than any other settler colonial, than any other anti-settler colonial struggle in the world. And the success of that struggle would be crucial and important to the remaining struggles of native and indigenous people all around the world, because it is the only struggle that has a chance to succeed in a way that would make other struggles more triumphant and more effective. So Palestine is still the issue because it is the place where settler colonialism still operates on a daily basis, like it used to operate on a daily basis 100, 200, 300 years ago. And it's not only motivated by the logic of elimination, it is also motivated by the logic of dehumanization. People who were persecuted in Europe, people who were victimized in Europe and colonized someone else's homeland, could not easily bring themselves to destroy another people when they themselves were victims to such barbarity. The only way they could do it was by dehumanizing the natives, the indigenous, by regarding them as lesser people, as subhumans. The treatment of Palestinians in the last 100 years is one of the longest, most ignored, most marginalized project of dehumanization in the modern era, in which supposedly the world is committed to fight against dehumanization and the degradation of other human beings. So we have to talk about Palestine and the Palestinian struggle, because the logics that propelled the genocides in this country, in South America, in Australia, in New Zealand, the inhumanity that propelled the apartheid in South Africa may be chapters of the past, but they are chapters of the present in Palestine. And the struggles have to fuse together in a way that will help us both rectify the past and look forward towards a better future. The second reason that Palestine is still the issue is its connection to anti-Semitism. The way the Palestine issue has been framed by the international media, politics, academia, is the worst way of dealing with a phenomenon that in any way is not very prevalent, but definitely is one that should be challenged, the phenomenon of anti-Semitism. The way the Palestine issue developed as a human issue, as a political issue, as a moral issue, was the wrong way of dealing with a problem that was never a Palestinian problem, but was a Christian problem, a European problem, an American problem. Hating Jews just because they are Jews. But you don't provide an antidote for such an hatred that is very long by allowing Jews to dispossess the Palestinians. You don't decrease the level of anti-Semitism by giving license to a group of Jews to become criminals. It is not surprising that the major result of Zionism is increase in anti-Semitism rather than a decrease in anti-Semitism. So if you want to find a proper way of dealing with anti-Semitism, because Europe has to have a closure for the genocide of the Jews in the Second World War, it is still not dealing with it properly. And Christianity needs a closure for the way it persecuted the Jews for so many centuries. But that closure would not come through Zionism and the support of the State of Israel. That closure would only come through pushing forward the agenda of human rights and civil rights for the Palestinians and the Jewish settlers in the land of Israel and Palestine. And therefore, Palestine is still the issue because anti-Semitism is so much an issue for so many people. Not so much as an exclusive way of racism, but as one of the worst kinds of racism, but by no means the only brand of racism that we know. And in many ways, as the fight against anti-Semitism should be infused with the fight against any kinds of racism, so should the struggle against Zionism and against the oppression of the Palestinian be seen as a struggle against racism and not as it is branded by Israel and its friends in this country as anti-Semitism itself. We have to invert the equation that is being made by saying that criticizing Israel is not only not anti-Semitism, criticizing Israel is the first most important step against anti-Semitism. The third reason that we should talk about Palestine as the issue is the issue of Islamophobia. As in the case of anti-Semitism, if you frame wrongly the conflict in Israel and Palestine, if you don't analyze properly what goes on there, if you highlight culprits who are victims, and you turn culprits into supposedly victims themselves, then you increase the kind of phenomenon that you supposedly want to fight against. In many ways, the Palestinians are the oldest victims of Islamophobia. It started in 1917, when the British Empire was looking for a way of tearing the Holy Land back to Christianity from the hands of the Ottoman Empire. They were looking for a way of doing it. This idea that Palestine should be in the hands of European powers in general and in British hands in particular was motivated by Islamophobia. It was a hatred for Islam, for being Islam. Not by any knowledge of Islam, not by any knowledge of what Muslims did or didn't do in the Holy Land. It was just a very narrow-minded view about Islam. The irony of history is that while Islamophobia was one of the major factors for why Britain was so interested in Palestine in 1917, it was fused with another racist idea, anti-Semitism. Because the idea of giving Palestine to a group of Jews who redefined Judaism as a national movement and promising that Britain would help them build a homeland in Palestine was a double bill for the policymakers in Britain during the First World War. You can get rid of the Jews by sending them to Palestine. And if you are a devout Christian, you may even believe that dispatching them to Palestine is part of a divine scheme that would precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and by that you're doing also an important Christian act. And you don't allow the Muslims any foothold in Palestine. So the three ideas of what you probably today would call Christian Zionism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia was directed as a powerful, destructive tool against the people who lived in Palestine. And that was the first moment in history where these notions of racism were translated into a policy that began a process of the destruction of Palestine and the Palestinian that culminates in what we see today in Israel and Palestine in 2016. So if we want to engage properly with all the dimensions of Islamophobia. This is not just the hatred of Muslims because they are Muslims. The war, the so-called war on terror, the radicalization of young people, the desperate violence of young people. If we will separate these issues from what goes on in Palestine, we won't have a proper conversation and we won't have the right engagement with an issue that plagues the Middle East, Europe, and the United States and has to be solved. We need to find a panacea for this kind of attitudes and ideas, and we cannot do it without struggling to understand what's wrong in Palestine and how can we push forward peace and justice in that land. Another reason that Palestine is the issue is because it is connected to social justice. It is not surprising nowadays around the world, in places as far as Venezuela, Norway, Malaysia, if you go and see people who are involved in industrial action, who are fighting for pay raise, if they are fighting against policies of the try to destroy their places of work, it causes unemployment. It's not surprising that so many trade unionists and so many activists for social and economic justice don themselves, cover themselves with a Palestinian flag. Not because there is any direct connection between what happens in Palestine and the struggle for better pay in Norway. There isn't. I'm not the person of conspiracy. There isn't such a conspiracy. It's because that Palestine symbolizes something that these workers understand is also happening to them. And what is it that they experience that makes the flag of Palestine an emblem for the struggle of social justice? It is the flag that shows that there is still hope for humanity to fight against hypocrisy, against exceptionalism, against double talk. Nobody who today raises the Palestinian flag is ignorant enough to think that what happens in Palestine is the worst thing that's happening in the world. Not one of the activists on behalf of Palestine or people who use the Palestinian flag in social justice movement do not know what's happening in the rest of the world. It's not out of ignorance. It is because the oppression of the Palestinians, the dispossession of the Palestinians, the settler colonialist project of Zionism has international legitimacy. And it has international legitimacy not as any other rogue state might have it. When the United States supports a dictatorship or a tyrant or a rogue state, everybody understands that it's done for strategic reasons. And people can criticize the United States for turning a blind eye for the violation of human rights in Saudi Arabia. However, in the case of Israel, it's not turning a blind eye to the human rights violation. It's claiming that there are no human rights violations in Israel. Ask the editor of the New York Times. Ask the editor of the news and CNN. I'm not mentioning Fox, I mean. Talk about the mainstream media and academia in this country. They will never teach the case of Israel in any course of human rights violation, on the history of colonization, in the history of ethnic cleansing, of genocide. Israel is always taught within the history of democracy, liberalism, modernity, the community of civilized nations. That's the hypocrisy. Not that there are no violations of human rights elsewhere. It's the only place where the political elite, the academic elite, the cultural elite, does not only say we're turning a blind eye to these human rights violations, we claim that they are not really human rights violations. They are acts of defense. They are progressive projects. They are democratic ventures for the benefit of everyone who lives between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. And that kind of hypocrisy connects the story of Palestine to the struggle of workers against neoliberalism around the world. Because neoliberal captains of the economy would use a language that seems to work for the benefit of workers, of societies, of communities, while destroying them, as you can see all over the United States. And this kind of affinity has brought a lot of people who are involved in trade unionism and labor struggle to see the struggle in Palestine as their own struggle. So for them, Palestine is definitely still the issue. Finally, and most importantly, Palestine is still the issue because it is the most important human rights issue today in the world. And it starts with that exceptionalism that I was talking about. It starts with this struggle of Palestinians for more than 100 years to say, how can anyone in the Middle East believe you? The rights violation, if for 100 years the worst kinds of human rights violation are totally ignored, are branded as something else, are not at all addressed. But it's not only the sense that you are being forgotten, it's not only the sense of the victim, the double sense of the crime. A crime was committed against you, but everybody tells you that you are lying when you say that that crime is being committed. Most of the Palestinians who were trying to pursue academic career as historians after 1948 were not allowed in the major universities in the world to write the kinds of books that I could in 2006. If they wanted, people like Waleed Khalidi, if they wanted to write a doctorate based on their own experience of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, they would say, come on, this is the figment of your imagination. This is your Oriental imagination. You cannot write, this is not scientific. We believe the Israelis, they are the enlightened progressive society. And they say that your leaders told you to leave and that's why you left, and they asked you to stay and you didn't want to stay. The whole narrative was not allowed to be challenged by Palestinians themselves in the Western academia because it was branded as storytelling, not scientific research. Whereas the Israeli propaganda, which was totally based on fabrication, was hailed as scientific work of the first instance. And this was true until very recently in this country, and still is in some places. So it is the issue of human rights because of the deception project that accompanies its the struggle against it. And it is only through a genuine, honest conversation about the violation of human rights in Palestine that we will be able, and we should be able, to be partners to the conversation in the Middle East about issues of human rights and civil rights. Because let's face it, the major problem today in Syria, in Iraq, in the Yemen, in Libya, in Egypt, is an issue of human rights. It's an issue of civil rights. Human rights are violated by regimes and are violated by those who oppose the regimes. The Middle East, in this respect, really suffers today and bleeding itself to death. And it needs help from the outside to discuss how to stop this violence, how to bring humanity into a place that now suffers from levels of dehumanization we haven't seen for ages. But we have to remember where did dehumanization, through which door did dehumanization enter the Arab world? During the years of the Ottoman Empire, there were violence occasions, of course. People did not always live in peace. I don't want to idealize it. But we have never seen the kind of genocidal developments and horrors as we have seen in Europe, in Southeast Asia, in America. The Middle East was free from that barbarity. It only started with the invasion of European colonialism, and even more so with the arrival of Zionism in Palestine. Because Arab rulers could look alike, could look around and say, well, it doesn't matter what you do to your people if you belong to the same club as Israel. Then you can do what you do. It is not what you do that matters, but how you're being branded. And there was this exceptional, rogue neighbor who could do to the Palestinians whatever they wished, and still hailed as the only democracy in the Middle East, as the paragon of what the Middle East should be. So if Israel is a model for the rest of the Middle East, what it should be, it means that the model is that you take any people, any nation that is in your way, and you try to eliminate it, and you dehumanize it in order to achieve your objective. That's the message. That's the message of the one society that supposedly in the Middle East represents civilization, progress, and modernity. And therefore we should discuss it. And therefore we should reteach the history of Zionism. That's why we should redefine Zionism for what it is, an ideology of settler colonialism and the state of Israel as a settler state. This is an important moral task that we have, not only for the sake of the Palestinians, also for the sake of the Jews who live in Israel. Because eventually, history teaches us that evil projects have an end, and they don't always end in a peaceful way. So we need to find a way for everyone, and for the Middle East as a whole, to have a different conversation about human rights. And I will end by saying that one of the... I lost track of time, but usually it's okay, you know. One important obstacle, we have to talk about it. One important obstacle that does not allow us to have a genuine, proper conversation about Palestine is the so-called peace process and the formula or the idea that underlies this process, the two-state solution. It is time to understand whether you supported this idea for genuine reasons, believing that it sounds like a rational solution, maybe because you thought that this solution will end at least the military occupation of the West Bank. Whatever your reasons were for thinking that this idea that is a hegemonic idea, that dominates the discourse, the speech, the conversations of politicians, diplomats, political elites, even moral activists, political activists who are involved with Palestine. If for whatever reason you thought this was a good idea, this was the kind of project you should work for, it's time to put an end to this. The two-state solution has died. And we still have some few months left in 2016, and I hope we will be invited to the funeral of that wrong idea. It wasted our time, this idea. It drained our energies where they were needed elsewhere to find a complex solution to a simple question. Palestine is not a complex issue. Settler colonialism was not invented in Palestine, and it's not the only place. How to solve a settler colonialist project in 2016 is a complex issue. How would the third generation of settlers live in peace with the current generation of indigenous native people is not an easy project. It's not an easy project. It needs to involve reconciliation, redistribution of resources, so that we won't have the kind of economic apartheid we are experiencing in South Africa today. You need to find some sort of restitution for past evils. It won't be easy. It will be very long. And I'm afraid that even it won't be all the time peaceful. But we wasted 50 years not doing that. Through the mesmerizing words or the mesmerizing concept of the two-state solution. It sounded so reasonable, so agreeable. And then we forgot one simple fact. The idea of partitioning a homeland can never come from the people who are the natives of a homeland. You remember Solomon's trial in the Bible. The real mother would never suggest to the king to cut the baby into two. Partition is an idea of settler colonials. Of course, everywhere, partition was one of the most important means for the settlers to take over the indigenous homeland. Because you are not powerful when you begin the settler colonialist project. So you partition the homeland. You take what you can, and then you take more afterwards. The story of Zionism in Palestine is exactly that story. They began with 7% of the land in 1948. They became the owners of 78% of the land in 1949, and 100% of the land is theirs in 1967. That's exactly what partition is. It's a practical, pragmatic means of a settler colonial movement to take over the land of the indigenous people. Now, anywhere else in the world, this is how it is described. I don't need to write a special book about it. In Palestine, this is described as peace, as progress, as enlightenment. This is an idea the Palestinians, of course, themselves could not conceive because they are a bit primitive. They're not as progressive as the Jews who constantly suggested partition. So the world said, okay, that must be a brilliant idea. I don't remember the number of people who received peace Nobel Prize. Nobel Peace Prizes, I'm sorry. For endorsing this idea of partition. So if Palestine is the issue, and Palestine is the issue, to make it the kind of issue that would affect the struggles against neoliberalism, the oppression of African Americans and Native Americans, the oppression of indigenous people all over the world, and the struggle for justice that I think has begun in 2008, we haven't yet seen it boiling and surfacing. It will come. I'm quite positive about it. Surprisingly, nowadays it's represented by two old gentlemen, one here and one in England, who are in their 70s. But it's a young idea. I wish them all well and long life, but we need some young people there now, not people who should retire politically. In order for all these issues to become connected and pushed forward, in order for all these, it's really time not to talk anymore about the two-state solution. It's time for the Palestinians to find a new definition of their liberation project. It's time for them to unite and find this definition. It's time for the international community to use the same yardstick of human rights and civil rights for Israel as it demands from itself and any other community. And I think, with this I will end, that if we will insist on all the issues that I mentioned tonight, we will be connected to its zeitgeist, to a spirit of a period that I think is there, but sometimes people are impatient when it just starts and they don't see kind of a revolution, when an evolution is taking place. I really think, and I strongly believe in it, that the skepticism about politics in this country and in Europe, the cynicism that young people feel that politics brings with it, and the kind of energies we have seen embodied in Syriza in Greece, Podemos in Spain, the Socialist Party in Portugal, the election of Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom, and the support that Bernie Sanders got here from young people, shows us that the next period, the next site, the next age is an age where a settler colonialist state of Israel would not be able to protect itself with fabricated narratives, with new speech, double speech, and the kind of struggles that we are all committed to will begin to reap the dividends we are all hoping for. Thank you very much.
My name is Kamal Hassan, and I am a 65-year-old Palestinian refugee still. First of all, on behalf of the Palestinian people, I want to thank you and many Israeli brave, such as yourself, Miko Pellet, Max Blumenthal, and others, Alison Weir. My question to you is, why do you do this for the Palestinian people and peace?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. It's a good question, not because I'm so interested why I'm doing it. Of course, we all ask these questions because we want to enlarge the number of Israeli Jews who are doing what we are doing. And I think that's why this analysis is important. You're trying to understand the transformation you yourself undergo, so to see whether you can really create a more massive movement of people who come from a similar background and may go in the same direction. And of course, the difficult thing of applying a personal story into political activism is that, of course, each human story of transformation is different from another. But there are some common issues, and I always remind myself the fact that there are, and there are even today, young Israeli Jews who are beginning, in various degrees of conviction, to feel the same things that I feel, means that despite of years, decades of fabrication, of indoctrination, of dehumanization, despite of all of that, there is always a group of people who are not blind. They can see the ruins of the Palestinian village. They can see with their eyes the atrocities committed against the Palestinians today. They can hear with their ears the cries of Palestinian children when Israeli airplanes attack them. And they can understand that they have at least the ability to talk, if not to act, on behalf of the people who are victims of their own state. This is not common only to us. I think it's common to many other people. But so that's one question, one answer to your question. The second one is really, I think, most people like myself who come from the comfort zone, and I think that was also true about Rachel, people who come from a certain privileged position in society, I think feel obliged, if they have a modicum of decency in them, feel obliged to do it. It's not a matter of why they are doing it. They really reach a mature point where they don't understand why others are not doing it. They don't ask themselves why they are doing it. And my feeling when I visit Israel, when I'm there, and I see my own generation, my children's generation, I really don't understand why we are so few inside Israel. And especially when the price we will pay, especially as Israeli Jews, does not compare to the price the Palestinians are paying. And I think this all gives strength for us to do it, but we are doing it for our humanity. We don't expect any reward, and we are doing it to ourselves, for ourselves and for anyone else. We regard this as our brothers and sisters. Thank you.
Hi.
Hey, Mark.
Hi. So I want to ask you actually to follow up a bit on what you just started to talk about now in the last answer. You know, I'm not one of these people who says we don't have the right to tell the Israelis or the Palestinians what to do, that we bear a responsibility as citizens of the world, and that if you I mean, if you talk to the South Africans, they will all say we could not have done it, even with our the resistance movements that we had, which are more robust than what you have in Israel and Palestine today. We couldn't have done it without the pressure of the outside world. That's what brought down the regime. So we have to do this. But having said that, what do you see going on in Israel today? Can you maybe share a bit from your own experience about what that is, and how can we best support that? And I'm talking about Israel.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for bringing to the light the pressure from the outside, and because I think the two are connected. The galvanized kind of public opinion behind the Palestine cause in this country, in the world at large, is the only, probably the only good news we have in the last 10 or 15 years. The growing effectiveness, popularity, and attractiveness of the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement is really something that, compared to everything else that goes on in Palestine, is really inspirational and gives you hope for the future. But I think we all are aware that this is not enough, that the pressure from the outside without the unity of the Palestinian movement from the inside, its clear definition of liberation, and of course the chances of any movement of change from the inside of the Israeli Jewish society, without these three components, it would be very difficult to envisage a different reality in Palestine. But I do think that the fact that the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement is so successful shows us that at least from the outside there is now not only a change in public opinion views on Palestine, there is now a powerful actor on the ground in Israel and Palestine that was not there before. The only international actors who were effective between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean were governments, international agencies. For the first time, we have representatives of the civil society who are there, and even if they are denied entry by Israel, they are still there. Meaning, you cannot, as Israel, do what you want and the world doesn't know. This was possible. You cannot claim or tell people that nothing wrong is happening to the Palestinians. These days are over. This is transparent. This is fully exposed. Now, that by itself, I know, is not bringing change. Any one of us who experienced talking to young Palestinians in the West Bank, in the Galilee, in Gaza, and talked to them and told them enthusiastically about the BDS as a new movement, knows how they shrug their shoulders and say, so what, last year was worse than the year before, so these news that you bring us do not plant any hope in our hearts and minds. And of course, you can understand that they want to see tangible results on the ground, but they will see them. I keep telling them, you cannot underrate this dramatic change in public opinion. It's a long process, I agree. And the last thing you want to ask people under oppression is to hold on, because it's very difficult to ask people who are suffering from the brutal, oppressive machinery of Israel to hold on, to say, believe us. We are now changing the public opinion in the world, and it will have an impact. And I really believe in it. On the same time, I'm not blind to the level of destruction. And in fact, as in the case of South Africa, when the pressure from the outside becomes effective, the ruler becomes more lethal, more brutal. That's the unfortunate coincidence of history we have to tackle, understand, but nonetheless not lose heart. Now, Mark, your question about what goes in Israel, what goes on in Israel in this respect, is very relevant. I think there are two processes that take place in Israel, and both of them are an inevitable consequence of the settler colonial nature of the whole Zionist project. One thing that happens is the total disappearance, but this is really total disappearance of something that could be called liberal Zionism. This idea that you can be an enlightened occupier, an enlightened ethnic cleanser, an enlightened colonizer, even Israelis themselves find it a bit ridiculous. So this whole notion that I'm still a Zionist, but I'm more liberal than the usual Zionist, I'm kind of a diet Zionist, is not working. In fact, I tell everyone, if you know any liberal Zionists, keep them alive. They are an extinct species. And one day, people would want to know, how does it look? How does a person who can square circles look like? They disappear. And when they disappear, it doesn't mean always good news. Because in their stead, what you have is, if you want, an unashamedly Zionist ideology prevailing, what I call neo-Zionism. That's even a worse version of Zionism than it used to be, if you look at it from the perspective of its victims, the Palestinians. Although I think also Jews are victims of Zionism, not just Palestinians. And this is this kind of historical moment where you have to be very brave, because they will be, even unfortunately, they will be more brutal. They will be even less sensitive about human rights and civil rights, if that is even possible. I think they will target people like me and you much more than ever they did before, not just Palestinians. This is now an inevitable historical process, but it is also a positive development. It's horrendous to say this, but it is. When you expose an evil reality for what it is, you can then galvanize people against it. If all the time people cannot see what's happening in Israel, it's very difficult to galvanize humanity against it. So that's one process. The process of the disappearance of the liberal game of Zionism. The positive process is that there is a small growing nucleus of young people who understand that this is the junction. An apartheid Israel or a democratic free Palestine. They know it. They know it. Unlike my generation, because they second generation or third generation of settlers, they have no shame of saying this is their homeland. They feel it's their homeland as much as it is the homeland of the Palestinians. And actually, from that perspective, it's much easier for them to say, we don't want to live in an apartheid state, even if that apartheid state gives us privileges. And we've seen a similar kind of impulse among young South Africans, young Americans who went to the South to fight for civil rights in the 1960s. This is not, we shouldn't be that desperate about humanity if we find some young people who say, oppression is something I'm going to fight against, even if my own state is the oppressor. We should hope this was a phenomenon that happened in history, and there's no reason to believe, to think they won't reappear. And I can see the buds of it within the Israeli Jewish society. And we are familiar with some of these NGOs, and they are growing. They are growing. One of the biggest secrets in Israel is how many people refuse to go to the army. The numbers are staggering. And the Israelis are not talking about it because they don't want to admit it. And the numbers, unfortunately, of suicide is very high in Israel among Israeli soldiers. It's not true that you can take young people and turn them into butchers and massacres in Gaza and think that doesn't do anything to them. It's not true. They also understand, if not immediately, a bit later, that they were part of a criminal project. So this is another phenomenon. But I think there is a dialectical connection. If we will empower and enhance the pressure from the outside, these groups will be empowered from the inside, and the Palestinians have their own agency to be united, to tell us exactly their vision of the future, which is not very clear, so that we can really start the long and painful, it will be a long and painful journey for restitution and reconciliation.
That recording was made on May 3rd at the University of Evergreen State University in Olympia, Washington. It was Israeli scholar Ilan Pape, and they were talking about why is Palestine still an issue. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Next up is Air Cascadia.
Over-reliance on incarceration has left millions of children emotionally cut off from the most important relationship of their young lives. Join Prison Pipeline on May 30th to hear Laura Speer from the Annie E. Casey Foundation discuss how children of prisoners are impacted and how the states and communities can help support these kids and improve their prospects for success. That's Prison Pipeline, May 30th at 6:30 p.m.